accession number 9552, reel 11.
Mr. Basil Farrer, Reel 11. I wonder if you could just explain why it was that these stretcher bearers were left to themselves during the day, whilst other troops might not well be occupied strengthening the trench.
Well, speaking logically, it's obvious for the moment they'd have nothing to do, but the next minute they could have something to do. They'd be always available and fit to carry them to carry the wounded, and he might quite a distance. He might be a very heavy man. It's hard work, apart from everything else. Carrying some of these chaps, a little chap was all right, but some of them were big. I remember them now. Speaking of carrying, there was one in B Company, and he was such an immense fellow when we were attacking. And that wasn't during this period, early period of 16, but when it ended, oh my God, if he ever is it, he'd be a terrific weight to carry. And I'll tell you about him later when we come to that. But there it was, it was hard work, and so the stretcher bearer had practically nothing to do so long as there were no casualties. So whilst all in the line, he was excused fatigues and things like that. At night time, if there were any anything special over in no man's land, he might stretcher might accompany them. So far,
we'll come to that. I just want to ask you one more thing about the daytime. When would you eat your meals? Was it arranged by anyone, or would you just eat as you felt when you felt hungry?
Oh no, it was arranged, and just during the ordinary quiet periods in quiet sectors. The Dixies, we'd have the ration parties, bringing up Dixies, either Dixies of tea or in the morning, it'd be Dixies of tea, and in the evening. Now, they didn't bring up warm meals except tea, didn't they? But they came later, bully beef, and then tins of pork and beans, which we all had a jackknife. That was part of our equipment, a jackknife with a lanyard. Pork and beans was generally a tin of beans with just a piece of pork fat. That was pork and beans. But then that was followed by McConaughey rations, which were quite a favourite, and troops would eat that cold, unless you could make a little fire in a dugout. You probably would have. In fact, I have a vague recollection that in parcels from home, there's some kind of little thing, inventive thing, where one could make a little fire, a smokeless fire, and warm your canteen, and you'd warm your tin of milk. Otherwise, you'd eat it cold, and the same with the pork and beans, you'd eat cold. So but out of the line, of course, then you'd, that is to say, when you're in reserve, then you'd have a warm meal midday. Stew and various things like that, and bacon, a bit of bacon fat, and if you're near the cookhouse, you'd dip your bread in it.
So in the normal course of events in the line, you'd pretty well have your meals at normal times.
Yes.
Now during the evening, could you describe what went on in the evening and when exactly you'd sleep and such like?
Well, unless there was anything special, why there might be a wiring party, because if there'd been any shelling, you'd have to go out and mend your wire. There'd be a wiring party, go out. They'd be detailed by the company officer. Well, the company officer would tell the company sergeant, who would detail men for different, if there are anything like that. And then, of course, there'd be the centre, a man on each fire step in each bay. And the others would just retire to the dugout and go to, get what sleep they could But the man on the fire bay wouldn't be there all night. I mean, it was like on sentry duty. I forgot. I'm speaking now not with surety, but logically. He wouldn't stay there all night. He'd be like on sentry duty, probably 2 hours, and then somebody else would have to come along. Because to stick on the fire step in a coal, because if you close your eyes, that was a court-martial crime and you're shot. If you were ever caught asleep on in the front line, that was really a serious thing. That was one part when we were read out King's regulations. That was the punishment. Now, in my regiment, there was never any such a case, but it occurred occasionally that we'd be paraded when we were out of the line and given an account of where a man had been shot, with no proof, but whether that would be true or just to put the wind up us, make sure, but sometimes it'd be read out that a man had been shot for various things.
Would a pair of stretcher bearers be on duty at night in case any casualties occurred? Would you be told you two are on for tonight?
No, it'd be the four of you being your dugout. We kept together, the four stretcher bearers. With so the two stretchers in the dugout, they'd be there, available for when wanted.
So they'd just come and get you if you wanted.
Yes.
What about when you were sent out into no man's land? You know, with a covering party or something. You'd be sent out in case there was a casualty amongst the covering party.
Yes.
Could you explain any examples of that? Can you remember being in no man's land ever?
Yes. Well, now the listening patrol, for instance, they'd go out, but you didn't accompany them. Oh no, you didn't accompany a listening patrol, because it was generally a corporal and a man, or two men. And I do remember particularly the case of a corporal and two men going out in a listening patrol. It would be in the early part of 1916, whether it was January, February, I honestly don't remember the date, but they went out. B Company, it was, from B Company. And the object of a listening patrol, obviously they don't understand German, but to get as near as they could to the Jerry trenches, and when they come back, to report any activity if Jerry's been mending in his wire, and if there are a lot of men in there, whether it appears there are a lot of men in the trench from the noises. I don't know really what a listening patrol could do, really. But nevertheless, they were sent out regularly, fairly regularly. And on this occasion, when it was sent out, and an ordinary night, things would be peaceful. You'd hear an occasional shot in the perhaps near to or nearby. But frequently, not all the time, a star shell would shoot up into the sky, the very light. We call them star shells, but the fucking thing was a very pistol, and they burst and they'd light up the whole area. Now, on this particular night, the patrol got caught in the area, in the glare of the, and the men, two men got back. Two men got back, but not the corporal. So, I think the sergeant was there and called the company officer. And then they questioned the men. Did you know whether he was hit or not? And they said they'd heard him yell out, but they thought he was telling them to get back, you see. So, anyhow, waited a while, thinking if he had been hit, perhaps hoping not seriously, he could crawl in, or perhaps not hit. Anyhow, so long it was evident that he wasn't coming in. So, we, as stretcher bearers, we were not on the spot at the time. Word, as I said, was passed down to our dugout. Stretcher bearers came along. We were told the situation. So we asked the men if they could give us some indication, the direction, and how far out they were when the machine gun, because as soon as the sergeant went up, the machine gun opened up, they were caught. Oh, well, they gave us a vague idea. All we could do was crawl out. So we, on the top, crawled. You don't walk on the top. I mean, another station will come up and down you go. So we crawled as noiselessly as possible. You just crawl along and pull in your stretcher. And we could have crawled for... But it was the morning of the chappie, We heard a gentle moaning. Somebody hurt. It drew us to him. It was the corporal, all right. And he must have got the full belt of the machine guns right through his stomach. And as we got to him, we pulled him in. First of all, we dragged him into... The place was pitted with shells, but into a fairly decent one, so that we could below the level, into the shell hole. And the movement revived him. Sort of, and he asked for a drink. Well, wounded in the stomach. It was elementary not to give a fellow food or drink, so badly wounded as he was. The bullets had gone right through him. He must have had a number. And we said, Corporal, we want to get you back first. Then, of course, he started telling us what he thought of us. His voice rose and became delirious. Up, the place was illuminated. Not one star shell, but half a dozen star shells, and the whole place was absolutely lit up, and machine guns were just sweeping. And all we could do was just lay flat in the shell holes. That went on for quite... I'm saying for quite a time. When you speak like that, you think it's a long time. It might have been, it might not have been. Especially as I'm speaking of an event that happened years ago. But I do definitely remember thinking, my God, if we don't get out of here, we've had it. If we don't get out by dawn. Because this was in the middle of the night, in the early hours of the morning. Dawn could break within an hour or two. And we didn't know how near we were to the Jetty's trenches. I mean, we'd crawled out in the dark. And now, the fellow was raving. All of a sudden he stopped and heard it. I don't know whether it is true, there's a rattle. There's a rattle in his throat, what they call a death rattle. And I actually heard it, and he died. Well, we couldn't leave the fellow there. If we put him on the stretcher to carry him, we'd be a target, so we started... put him on the stretcher and on dragging him along. That was a very, very slow process. But the peculiar thing now, looking back, and at the time, I do remember, there was no more star shells going up, and everything was quiet. And it was that in time it dawned upon me, and upon us, we heard something behind. We were obviously being followed. Jerry was after us. Well, we'd only the stretcher, and obviously I didn't like the idea, because we wouldn't be shot. Had it shot us in no man's land, it created a noise, and our machine guns had opened up. He'd have probably just cut our throats. Well, that wasn't... I said we'd better get in. And he didn't. They didn't. Well, I suppose they didn't. They couldn't move any faster than... We got on a strike, and we did get to our front line. But there again, we had a narrow escape. Now, this is true. It's perfectly true. When I say we'd come out from B Company, A Company's facing a thing. When coming in, we were coming into A Company. They'd heard all the blinking shemozzle, the early shemozzle, you know, the firing and then the star shells, and they thought there was a race pending, and the company had stood too. Then they saw crawling figures, they thought that there were Jerry's. And I didn't know what was going to happen, but I saw we were near, and saw the... near the trench, and I yelled out, "B Company stretcher bearers coming in just in time to stop a volley in our direction, otherwise we'd have had it from them." And as we were handing the dead corporal in, there was a bit of a schmozzle, something went over my head, and it was a Jerry. They'd caught up with us just, I don't know how many, one or two, I don't know, but they got one, and I thought there was two, because it was not until next morning. I don't know if there was two, whether the chap got away, whether he was killed, I don't remember. But next morning we did find a German Spudmasher bomb, a German hand grenade. We call them the Spudmasher type. And they captured one, this fellow. And next day, or within a few days, I heard that the chap that had pulled him in had got a leave for doing so. We always want to the people behind always want to know what regiments are in front of us, and he got a leave.
Do you remember anything about this German that was captured?
No, don't. I mean, we handed the body in and then we went back to our dugout, left them to it.
Did you often have to go into no man's land like that, on a mission like that?
No. I have no recollection of having done so, not in the ordinary way, that is to say, the ordinary, when we say holding, when there's no actual fighting, we were holding the line. In other words, Jerry was in his front line, we would be in ours. There'd be various jobs going off sometimes at night, wiring parties or patrols, but you didn't accompany them, only in the event of a casualty.
When there was a casualty, like in this occasion with the corporal, why was there nobody sent out with you to act as a guard to you, in a sense? Because you were alone and unarmed in no man's land.
Well, the thing is, had we been attacked, they couldn't have started firing in no man's land, because if you start shooting in no man's land, up go the place is lit up in very quick time, and machine guns open out on from both sides. So they couldn't very well protect you. There's not much they could do about it. I mean, they either shoot and stand up to have a blinking stabbing match, well, then you'd have other casualties. No, there's no. I don't think there's any question of being protected. You just went out to get the man, and if you could, it just so happened that in this case, this corporal became delirious. So normally, if a man's wounded, say, through the leg, smashed, he's not delirious. You just you're working quietly. You're working as quietly as you can, because any noise brings immediately star shells go up. And machine guns just sweep the ground. It's like a sweeping fire with a machine gun.
Were there any raids, either by your battalion or by the Germans, during this period before the Battle of the Somme?
Let me see. No, not during that period. I remember there was a raid by. I've never been in the front line when the Jerry's raided us. I've never experienced that. I must be truthful there. I've never experienced a Jerry raid. I remember there was a raid, and I don't think it was in that period. It was later. I think it was in another sector.
We'll come to that then.
One of our raids, one of our people went over. A party went over.
But in the Carnoir section of between January...
No, there's no. Nothing? No. And the distance was fair distance between the two lines, there was. Quite a distance. When I say quite a distance, anything from 100 to 200 yards, and perhaps more. But we weren't close enough, as in some sectors, where you could fire rifle grenades and exchange trench mortars. We weren't as near as that on the Somme.
I'd like now to... it's not fair to call it routine fighting, but day-to-day fighting, the sort of fighting that went on, not major attacks, but just the drip-drip of trench warfare. If we could look at artillery fire, was there much artillery fire in the Carnoir section in this period?
Not a tremendous amount. Not a tremendous amount. There would be a bit, and then, of course... And we'd read in the papers perhaps a week later about there'd been an artillery duel, and people probably reading the paper, an artillery duel, would think that the artillery are firing at each other. But it was always their artillery firing onto our front line trenches and our artillery firing onto ours. So we were the chaps who were in the middle of this duel. And it occasionally happened, but not... In that sector, no. In certain sectors where you're near enough to exchange, as I say, and grenades, it could develop into a trench mortar would go over. They'd send one. Then somebody telephoned back for the artillery to support them, and then the artillery would join in and quite a schmuzzle for about an hour or two, and the poor infantrymen were receiving the order, and that gradually died down. But that is in there. But on the Somme, it was comparatively quiet. There were casualties from an occasional shell and from occasional bullets, snipers, and often when we were going in and out of the trenches. Because they had certain roads, they knew points which they knew when we were being relieved we had to cover, and they'd probably open up then, and when we had one or two casualties like that. I remember Bomfrey Farm, which was quite a distance behind the line where we used to go in reserve, our section, I remember a fellow, we'd already crossed the Bray, what's it called, the Albert Perron Road, we'd crossed it, and then there was the road was straight, and the chap got a bullet there, and it didn't go right in, it just penetrated, and he couldn't pull it out. He couldn't, it had gone in, but it was so, the flesh gripped it so much that he couldn't pull it out. When we got to Mumfrey Farm, they went to the MO and the MO just pulled it out. So it was within rifle range.
How did that, what was it like being under the threat of this desultory artillery fire? Did it affect your nerves at all in that way?
No, because really, I can't express my feelings now because it's so long ago. But I would say that we got used to that. It was part of the day's thing. We'd just hope for the best. We'd just hope for the best.
Could you, with experience, I mean, when you'd been in there 4 or 5 months in the line, could you tell where a shell was going to land, or did it give you any sort of inkling?
No, but sometimes you'd hear it. You could hear it when it was fired for the gun. You could hear it then it come whizzing over. But in the front line, in the kind of war distance, there wasn't too much heavy shelling, whiz bangs and things like that would come flying over. Especially when on Russian parties and things, they knew the roads and they'd send over whiz bangs but not heavy stuff. It was fairly quiet, and I think we could be in the line. As far as our company's concerned, I don't know what's going on in other companies, and not have a casualty at all during the 4 or 5 days we're in the line.
So from what you said earlier, you wouldn't have mortar fire. It was the range would be too long for mortar fire.
For mortar fire, yes.
What about sniping? Our sniping and their sniping. To start with ours, would the British have many snipers out or looking?
No, I only know of. We had, I suppose, but in my company, I only know of one who was a particular friend of mine. He was a Londoner. Sparks was his name. I don't know whether I've told you this, but I asked him how the dickens he got into the Yorkshire Regiment. And this was before the 14th War, he was a regular soldier. And he said he was outside the thing looking at all the posters of all the wonderful uniforms we wore in those days, and sergeant called him in and had a chat, and he was undecided, and Sergeant suggested the Yorkshire Regiment. No, first of all, he wanted to join a cavalry because he fancy uniforms. Couldn't Sergeant put him up, told him he'd have to look after his horse when come in, and that was his first duty. And whilst jingling spurs in the infantry, you could be jingling the money in your pocket. So all that kind of talk. Anyhow, he suggested the Yorkshire Regiment. Now, this is only my own personal opinion now. I think recruiting sergeants at the time probably had received instructions to push for certain regiments who were what we say under strength. That is not up to a full fighting strength of a battalion. In those days, used to be around about 1,000, and some were less. And I suppose recruiting sergeants would get instructions to push for those regiments. Maybe the Yorks must have been one. Anyhow, because we had a number of Londoners in. I said, how come? He said, well, he suggested the Yorks. And so his answer, why the Yorks? The recruiting sergeant said, Depot, Richmond. Well, being a Londoner, he naturally thought of Richmond, London. And he saw him weekend leaves. Right. Took the oath, signed, took the shilling. Then the recruiting officer gave him a railway one. He said, I don't need one for Richmond. He said, yes, you do. St. Pancras, there's a train at Somers, Richmond, York, and that is true. That's what Spark told me. Anyhow, he was, that's just by the way, he was a sniper, and I was with him, and not with him when he was actually killed, but he'd already got three. I was with him on one occasion when he was wounded. He told me on one occasion, I forgot where it was, he got it through the mouth and he was down. And he heard a party coming along during the night for collecting the wounded and burying the dead, and he heard two fellas say, oh, he's dead, and Sparks thought they were going to bury him, and he recovered, he jumped up and he had a bullet right through his mouth and he ran for his life. He thought they were going to bury him. Anyhow, When he did eventually die, he had 3 wound stripes. But this is how he died. He told me, and it was the first time I'd seen a rifle with a telescopic lens. I'd never seen one before. And he'd had one issued to him. And he'd been named B Company sniper. And he showed me this rifle. And he said, I've just arranged a nice little post. And he, obviously, this little post, it was little in the trench, I think, or just a little sap from the trench, but so arranged, he was down, but nevertheless, for him to fire, it had to be, the muzzle had to be out. And I can only conclude that when he was fixing it, this,
telescopic sight.
The glass must have reflected on the light from the other side, must have seen it. Because what happened, because he couldn't use it, the idea was using it in daylight, you can't see anybody. Dawn came, he came to fire, the rifle in position, and the fellow opposite must have been similarly armed, he must have been. Went right through his head and killed him. Sparks didn't have time to. That was the only sniper I ever come across. Sparks. And he already had 3 wound stripes before that happened. But I was with him once going up on a party, accompanying the Russian party going up, and he was in front of me, and whether I turned or he turned, he got the bullet instead of me. And he cut through here. Didn't go plainly straight, but it knocked him unconscious and he was evacuated, of course. That was one of his wounds when he was with me.
Did battalion snipers or company snipers like Sparks, did they have a reputation as of any sort? Because it's an unusual job.
No, I can't. I couldn't answer the yes or no. I can't. I don't remember if they did. Not as far as I recollected, no particular reputation, no.
What about German sniping? What sort of effect did it have and what sort of precautions would you take?
Well, you'd warn your pals about if you were passing a certain point, be careful, passing there, then the sniper's got that fixed, you see. Or going down a communication trench, you'd come out at the trench. Well, you'd warn the fellow, be careful there. Because the bullets, our 303, I think it was 2,000 yards. I think we could, that was the thing. Well, of course, at the end of this, it wasn't 2,000 yards away. And less than 2,000 yards, they would probably, as I say, that chap getting the bullet like that, even that if it had gone in his head, might have killed him. But to be really effective, it's got to be much less. And, I don't remember anything particularly with regard to snipers. In any event, on the Somme, it's perfectly true that on the Somme, there wasn't too much, from my recollection, sniping. There could be stray bullets that could hit you. Sniping, you've got to be fairly near. You've got to be fairly near. First of all, to have a sniper's post. You're not going to have a sniper's post in the front line trench. It's got to be some place and camouflaged in some way. So we didn't have much sniping. It was mostly from shell and stray bullets.